I guess.
Okay, all right. So, good morning. We are glad that there are some people here this morning after the cheese and wine party. anyway, so this is Nicolas, I'm Ralf, and we are going to talk about, in stereo, in fact, about shell scripts. Shell scripts in general and Debian maintainer scripts in particular. So, let me first start by reminding you what this is, maintainer scripts in Debian. Most of you will probably know this very well. So this is a citation from our CRATE policy, and we will have quite some citations from the policy. So a DEP package contains two sets of files in general. The first is a set of files to be installed on the system when the package is installed, which we call the static contents of the package. And then you have a set of files that provide additional metadata about the package or which are executed when the package is installed or removed. Among those files are the package maintainer scripts. So these are the scripts we are interested in and we are talking about today. And these maintainer scripts, you might have up to four of them in any single binary package. These are the pre-inst, post-inst, pre-RM, and post-RM. And their function is very roughly, well, when you install a package, then first you execute the pre-inst script, if it is present in the package. Then you unpack the static contents, the tarball, and then you execute the post-inst script. And when you remove a package, it's the reverse with the RM scripts. So first you execute the pre-RM script, then all the static contents of the package is removed from your file system, and finally you execute the post-RM script. And the situation is a little bit more complicated when you upgrade the package or when you downgrade the package, because then there's a mixture of these scripts of the old and the new version of the package, which are executed with additional arguments passed to these scripts in order to indicate to them what precisely is happening. Okay, so these are the things we would like to analyze formally to know whether they are correct. Looking more into what this means, a breakdown of what we have currently about maintainer scripts. So these are numbers from which are more or less recent from May. We had at that time about 50,000 binary packages in SIT, and counting all the maintainer scripts, we arrived at about 30,000, which means that not every package has them. About these 30,000, well, you probably know that many of or large parts of these maintainer scripts are today automatically generated by DepHelper stuff. But anyway, we find among these 30,000 about one third, which contains at least a part of the script which has been written by hand, so which has not been inserted by some of the DepHelper stuff. And by the way, we did some similar stuff, more basic analysis, some 10 years ago in the Mancusi project, and there we obtained similar figures about the portion of maintainer scripts which are partially written by hand. So apparently this doesn't move too much over time. So about 10,000 scripts are at least partially written by hand, which means they potentially contain bugs and contain errors. And this is something we should worry about, because these maintainer scripts are executed as root when you install a package on any machine. So we should be defensive in writing these scripts, and we should be sure that they are correct. A breakdown by language, so almost all of them are POSIX shell, with a few exceptions. So there are about 230 bash scripts, bin bash, 16 Perl scripts. There are 5 ASCII files. These are the findings according to the file utility. And ASCII files means these are shell scripts which do not have the shebang. We will come back to this case a little bit later. And there are even 2 ELF executables. And these are, in fact, for the packages of bash and of dash. And this is quite normal, because obviously you cannot write their pre-inst scripts as a shell script, because you don't have an interpreter when you install the stuff. Okay. So what policy says about maintainer scripts is, well, they are not required to be shell scripts, as we already have seen on the previous slide. C shell and TC shell are discouraged for various reasons. So there are several papers and documents available on the web which explain to you why it is bad to program in any of these languages. The policy says that they should start on a shebang and indicate the type of the language which is used in the script. They should use set minus e. Set minus e puts the shell into a mode which we call in DBR the strict mode, but this is not a POSIX terminology. The strict mode means that when there is a command which fails, then the shell script itself will fail and it will not continue execution of the script. This is what you usually would expect for a maintainer script, because if something unexpected happens, you want to fail it noisily so you see that something went wrong. However, the set minus e, the strict mode, one has to know that it is temporarily disabled in certain situations and during execution of a shell script, and we will also come back to this. So the POSIX standard for a long time, in fact, when we started our project, the version of the POSIX standard which was mandated by policy was an old version, and quite recently this was updated, so policy now talks about the version of the POSIX standards of 2017, which is great, thanks a lot for that. Unfortunately, POSIX recently updated to a 2018 version, so we probably will have to try to update this again. The policy also says that any shell interpreter should implement the POSIX standard with some POSIX standard with some additions, with some Debian specific embellishments, and this concerns the echo built in. If it is implemented, it should support the minus n option. The test, when it isn't built in, it should support the minus a and minus o option. We will also come back to this. It should support local scopes and the local keyword, and we will also talk about this, and also some stuff we don't care about in the context of our project, because in our project we will ignore concurrent stuff and signal stuff. Okay, so we will look at POSIX shells with these Debian-specific extensions. Now, what we are trying to do in this project globally is to get a formal assertion of the correctness of these maintainer scripts. That is an assertion that they are behaving correctly on a semantic level. In fact, to those of you who have been in Cape Town 2 years ago at DebConf, I gave a talk at that occasion where I presented the project and I gave an example of one of my own maintainer scripts which was wrong and which did terrible stuff because it removed too many files when you remove the package. Okay, so these are the kind of bugs we would like to find at the end of our project. I tell you right away, we are not there yet. So we took a lot of time by working on the front end of our toolchain, and this is in fact what we are going to talk about today. So this is about formal analysis. Formal analysis in the sense of program verification, or formal program verification. This is not testing. So we would like to get by formal analysis really an assertion of the fact that our scripts behave correctly in any possible legal situation. So it's much stronger assertion than only testing. So possible outcomes, well, we could probably get an assertion of correctness, but there one should also be aware that all one can hope for is to obtain an assertion of correctness in some abstraction of a model, of the model of the system, since anyway what you have on a real Unix system is a quite complex thing, and you cannot, probably you won't be able to model all of this completely in something which can be handled by program verification. Another possible outcome, and this is probably something which will be much more useful for Debian, is bugs and finding possible bugs in packages, and we have already found quite of them for the moment on a quite trivial syntactic level. Okay, and this is what we talk about today, and the first step to obtain a toolchain which does all of this is to start with parsing of shell scripts to obtain a syntax tree for shell scripts, and this is what we did first.
Thank you. So that was already the topic of a talk that Ralf and Jan, another colleague, had in MiniDebConf Hamburg about why parsing POSIX shell is hard and how we did it in our project. The problem with PostExcel is that it's not designed to allow parsing of whole files. It's designed to you should parse first one complete command, then execute it, and then you can go back to parsing. Which means that when you want to parse a whole script, you can get into trouble. Also, in order to have nice features like being able to write makedir for or things like that, you have a parser that must be speculative and maybe promote keywords to keywords and try things, and if that doesn't work, try something else, which is also hard to write. Yes. And one specificity of PostExcel is also these here documents. And the difficulty about parsing here documents is that they are not local things. So first you pass your a command, and when passing that command, you discover that there will be a certain number of here documents that you will have to pass afterwards. And so you have to keep information about what you will need to do after passing your command. And in fact, in general, parsing statically one full script is undecidable, because you can have aliases, maybe in branching conditions, which makes it hard even on a syntactic level to know that, to parse the full file. So we have a parser that's called Morbic. It's available on GitHub if you want. It's written in the language OCaml, and it uses one parser generator mania. So this is something we are proud of, the fact that we use the parser generator. The usual parsers for Dash and Bash are in fact pieces of C code, handwritten, working on a character level basis. And in our case, we were able to use really like the grammar that was in the specification of POSIX. The mania parser generator is a great tool that allowed us to not only write the grammar, but write the exceptions in the grammar that are required in order to have these speculative parsing that shell requires. It allows that by giving you a way to introspect the status of the parser and to maybe update it yourself if you want. That is, you can look at the parser, say, oh, it's starting to parse, I don't know, a new command. So this is a place where if you read for, this might be a keyword. When you are somewhere else, you say, I already have started parsing my command, I read for, I will keep it as a simple word and work that way. So this is something that is provided by these mania parser generator. This allows us to have mainly really high-level code that you can easily relate to the standard. So you take the grammar that is written in the standard, you take the grammar that is written in our tool, and you can see that they do the same thing. And if you want to know more about all the things that happen inside this tool, there is already probably the mini-depconf talk in Hamburg that has been recorded. What Morbic produces is what we call a concrete syntax tree. This is a huge tree with, in our case, like more than 50 recursive type definitions. And in fact, what this tree represents is all the grammar rules that have been used to parse the script. So I don't know if that's readable on the slides, but you have like one type per grammar rule, so a complete command, a C list, and or. And then one constructor of type per rule of the grammar that you applied in that case. So this corresponds directly to the grammar of the POSIX standard once again, and so you can work on really what has been used. In our case, we will want to crawl through these trees, to traverse them, to look at certain places like what happens in redirections, in function definitions, and so on. Since it's a huge tree, we would have to code functions for all the cases of the tree, saying mostly just keep going down in the tree and traverse the tree. So that would be really painful. Hopefully, we use something called the visitor design pattern, So there are what we call visitors, and you have several kinds of visitors that are generated automatically, so we don't do that, in the Morbic parser. And what they are objects that just do nothing but traverse the whole tree, which means that you can later just inherit from these objects and override just the part that is of interest, and it makes it really easy to write something that go look into only simple comments, not touching the rest. We'll have an example in a moment. So once we have this parser and these nice tools, we've written a tool just that runs statistical analysis of shell scripts, because we wanted to know what was in this shell script, because that would guide our intuitions and what we would do in the project. So this is another tool that is also available in GitHub. We call it SH Stats. We didn't have a fancy name for it, but it's nice. It worked directly on the syntax tree that Morbig outputs. It has a pre-processing phase for the shells, for the scripts, where it tries to expose the parameters that you can know locally. That is, if you have a constant that is defined at the beginning of your document, you are able to replace it everywhere in the document. Ralph will talk about that later. And because of the visitor design pattern, it's easy to add an analyzer module. And here is an example. So it's quite a lot of stuff, but let's break it down to pieces quite fast. So analyzer, you just have to give it a name, and you give it a name and the command line options that it requires. That's just for SH states to know who this analyzer is. And then you write a process script function that will just be the way SH states provide the scripts to the analyzer. And in that case, it's a simple analyzer that just tries to see if there are, if you can find dollar, the character dollar, in the words. And what you do is you create an object, so it starts here, you create an object, you inherit from one of these visitors, and you just have to override one method, and this is what is here. You just override the method that visits the words. So all the other functions will still be the same and will just crawl the CST. And this specific function will just test whether you have a dollar in the word, right? Which makes it like in 10 lines, you've written something that goes down the whole tree and read at a certain place in the grammar if there are dollars. All right. And then what you do is you just ask this object to crawl the whole tree, and if it returns that yes, indeed I found a dollar, you add the file name into a list of files that contains dollars. I think. Right.
Okay.
And then you have just to be able to output a report about what the analyzer did. In that case, you just write, here is the number of scripts containing a dollar, and then the list of scripts if you want to see why they are here and what kind of dollar they have. Right. In that case, just counting dollars could have been done with grep, and actually that's what I was doing like 2 years ago, a lot of grep things. Except that then you see that you have detected dollars that were in comments, so you have to remove comments. You can still do that with sed, maybe. And then inside quotes, and then there are here documents that are not expanded, so you shouldn't count the dollars in there. And then, so each time you see that.
Mm-hmm. So it's one per line, so if I have five on one line, you only get one count.
I can't hear you, sorry. Please go to the mic.
Okay. So I think what Dan was saying, if you do a grep, you get only one occurrence per line, which is counted. But I think there are options to grep which allow you to count all the occurrences on the line.
Well, so the point is grep is limited limited. It does what it is supposed to do, but we need more than that here. And In this case, so first, having really this parser and this tree traversal allows us to have this expansion phase that helps us like expanding variables. We'll talk about that, I think, in the next slide. And then you can do much more complicated things, like if you count the dollars, but you don't want to count a dollar that is a variable bound by a for loop, for instance, we can do that easily in our tool and grep will completely. Well, it's not made for that. And I'll leave Ralph to talk about this expansion.
So I would like to talk a little bit about this expansion, which might seem trivial at first sight. So what it does is, I recall you that we try to analyze the script statically, that is without executing it. However, there are some, when we do that, we often, when you write a shell script, you do definitions, bindings of variables, which are in reality constants. So you bind them once, and then you use the same value for the same variable all the time. And we would like to exploit this in our analysis. So stuff like this, so you define a variable x, and then in a branch you define a variable y. So you would find in line 4, in fact, statically, even that x must be 1 and y must be 2. And on line 7, you would find that x still must be 1, and now y must be 3, because now you executed the else branch and not the then branch. However, if you drop out of the conditional, then you know still that x has value 1 because you haven't changed it anyway during the conditional. However, you don't know now what the value of y is. It could be 1 of 2 or 3, but we are doing not this kind of set-based analysis. Now we just would exploit the fact that we know that x has value 1 and y, we know nothing about y. Okay, so this looks quite easy. However, it is shell, and shell is weird. And well, let's start to explain why we think that shell is weird. Let's do a little quiz. So imagine you have a shell script, and in the shell script you have these three lines written on top of the slide. So x is 1, then you have something like x equals 2 and a call to something foo, whatever, and then you do echo dollar x. So what should, in your opinion, be the value which is printed by this? So possible choices. I give you 5 choices. The choices are 1, 2, 73, syntax error, or it depends.
5.
Okay, any other opinions?
Well, I could, but I
5. Okay, 5. So 2 people are saying it depends. Very good. It depends on what? Yeah.
Okay, at x equals 2, that variable setting is scoped to the line. So at first, when you're just learning shell and learning it well, you would say, oh, well, because that variable assignment goes out of scope after the command is executed, x must equal 1. However, it's not that, you can't be so sure, because foo might be something that sets x and then re-exports it to the environment.
That's true, too. Okay, so it depends. Okay, thank you. So it depends, in fact, on several things. The first thing it depends on is whether foo is a function or a special built-in of the shell, on the one hand, or whether foo is an external command which will be spawned as an external process. So if foo is something like bin whatever, which spawns a process, then, in fact, the assignment of x to 2 is local to this line. So in this case, you would see the value of 1. However, if foo is a special built-in of the shell or is a function, then the assignment of x to the value of 2 will be global to the context of the shell. And in this case, you will see the value of 2. However, if foo is a function, foo itself can also set the variable x, as you correctly pointed out. And then you could indeed obtain the value of 73 in this case. Yeah?
However, the oldest shells didn't have functions, so it must be 1, if you're using the oldest shells.
Well, we are talking about POSIX shells, and POSIX shells must have functions. So this is definitely something in all the shells which are permitted by policy, something which is possible.
And special built-ins anyway.
And special built-ins. Okay, so I think we have to hurry up a little bit. So just to show you that this is a more complicated case, So this is kind of surprising. In case you don't know what it means, so here you have a prefix, then you have here something which will spawn a process, and then you echo something. And in fact, what happens here is, well, I can execute it. It's dash assignment process. What it does is, it prints A. So this is the first line. This prints A, which is kind of surprising, because in the prefix you said that X is B, and Y is something, and also C gets an assignment by parameter expansion here. However, this is not yet visible when you expand the suffix of the command, which is kind of surprising. Okay, then we have seen the spawner process. So all the assignments which have been done by the prefix should not be visible after execution of the process. However, what we see with dash, and it will be the same with bash and POSIX mode, is we see A and C, which means that Y, the assignment of Y, really is not visible here. However, the assignment of C, of Z, is. So it's kind of weird. So the semantics is weird, and the syntax is weird, and we are having a lot of fun of discovering various features of the shell here. So it's not trivial at all. So what we found effectively on analyzing the corpus of maintainer scripts. First, we found some really, really trivial things which would not have required a parser at all. So this was really, really easy. The first thing is missing shebangs in maintainer scripts. In fact, policy says they should be there in the maintainer scripts. And we found about 40 packages which did not have them. And then we did, according to our regulation, to our rules, what has to be done. So we announced a mass bug filing. There was some discussion about the severity which would be appropriate for this. And we settled on important. And almost all of them have been fixed so far. So thanks for that. There are only 5 remaining of them. And these 5 are precisely the 5 ASCII scripts, ASCII files I talked about. When I did the breakdown according to language. Then Z-E. Z-E is necessary to make shell scripts fail in case one of the commands in the shell script itself fails, and they should be there. This should be done by any maintainer script, either by setting Z-E, this is the normal way to do it, or by taking care of the way how you launch, how you invoke external commands and make them fail. Fail with an exit one in case there is something not expected. So we found again some 50 packages which do not follow this policy. I looked at all of these cases to ensure that the maintainer did not something else to make it fail as it should, and we did some mass bug filing again after discussion, and about a quarter of them have been fixed so far. Then we have the case of local. Maybe we should skip over this because we are already a little bit short of time. Local is also strange in shell. Everything is strange in shell. The reason why local is shell, just very, very quickly, is local does not have an end, as in Java, where you have a bracket group and then you have a local variable local to that bracket group. Local in shell just says, from now on, that variable is local. Okay. And then you made stuff something like this, which makes a variable X local dependent on something which happened before. And this means that the parser, if you imagine that you would like to write a compiler for shell, a parser cannot know whether a variable is local or not. And that's strange. Okay, again. And we found indeed that there are some cases. We did this just yesterday, so this we didn't look into this in detail, but there are 280 cases indeed where there is a local inside a control structure, of a while sometimes even. And we have to look more in detail into this to see whether this is a problem. Then we have more stuff. I think we should skip also over this. Then we did an analysis of the commands, and I give back to Nicola of the commands, and we did this in fact because we just wanted to know which commands are mostly used in the scripts in order to know how we should build up our model.
All right. Okay. I was just checking you weren't seeing the results. So in your opinion, what would be the 3 most used? So maybe we won't do that, we don't have time, but you can just imagine what would be the 3 most used, do you really see that?
Okay, you can read it. Okay.
All right, it's visible. So the first one is test, which occur in like half of the scripts, but then more than, like in average, four times the script. People seem to like tests, that's good. Then you have set, which is present in most scripts, which is something we almost already said. The third one is true, actually, in number of occurrences, not files, because people love to do or true just to forget about a mistake. So there are not so many files using them, but when they do use them a lot. And then you have others. So we have interesting, maybe you have which, that is not, so here you have which is present in like half of the files. So if we were to order them by files, it would be set, then test, then which there. And we see dpkg main script helper, that's good to see it there, or depth system d helper. And maybe we won't pass so much time on this slide. So we have an analyzer that gives us which commands are used and in which way. So for instance, if you look at in which way set is used, you see that in a huge amount of cases, it's for the minus E flag, which once again is not really surprising. If we look at like potentially dangerous commands like remove, you have that most of the time it's the force flag that is used, and sometimes recursive and force, which is like the frightening part. And if you look at, for instance, dpkg, you can see that so four out of five cases of dpkg are just there to list the files of the package, probably to remove some of them. Maybe I'll just keep do it. And yes, when you look at that, so the first thing you have to do is you look at what is used the less, because it's sometimes where weird things happens. All right. And for instance, this is how you can see that you discover makedir minus f, you say, what is it? You check that it doesn't exist, and we find a few bugs like that. In that case, it was makedir minus p. Do you want to?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So then we looked a little bit more in detail on tests. We wrote a little parser for the test expression itself. And so we have here some statistics about the different comparison operators and unary file test operators. We won't talk about this. I would like to talk about something else, which is more interesting, in fact. Well, maybe here you see these are the binary operators, which are mostly used. Luckily for us, the last two ones are not POSIX. They are supported by GNU. GNU test, and in fact NT is newer than comparing the timestamps, and EF, this would be troublesome for us for doing theoretical modelization of file systems, because it means comparing whether two passes point to the same inode, and if this were used a lot, it would mean that you would have to model file systems like DAGs, like graphs. And the fact that this is not used means we can just model them as trees and just ignore the cases where something like EF is used. I would like to talk about minus A and minus O. Why? Because they are mentioned in the policy. So policy again says test, if implemented as a built-in, must support minus A and minus O. Minus A and minus O are for AND and for OR to combine complex tests. However, when you look at what POSIX says, well, it's obsolete. First of all, it's an extension only. It's not in the core of the POSIX standard. And furthermore, it's mentioned as being obsolete, and it's recommended not to use it. Why? In fact, the GNU page says exactly the same thing, and the reason why both recommend to not to use it any longer is the same, because it's ambiguous. And why is it ambiguous? Well, this comes from the fact that test expressions contain also a special case which allows you to write a test without any operator. In fact, if you write in the test expression only one single word, it is already a valid test. In fact, it is a test whether that word is non-empty or not. So like writing a minus n in front of it. In this case, you can just drop the minus n, and that makes the whole thing completely ambiguous. For instance, a valid test expression is something like this, parenthesis equals parenthesis. And there are two ways to read this. And first of all, you might find strange that someone would write it, but maybe someone didn't write it directly, but he wrote parentheses $1 equals $2 parentheses, and then these two parameters are expanded to nothing, and then you obtain what you have written here. In fact, you can read it either as left parentheses is the same as right parentheses, this would be false, or you could read it as the string equal is non-empty, and this test is written between parentheses, and this would be true. So it's ambiguous in its structure, and in fact, this can also lead to an ambiguity in the result, which would be obtained. And then you can do funny stuff like this. This is in fact legal, a legal test, minus A, minus A, minus A, minus A, minus A. For me, there's only one possible reading, but apparently there are other opinions, because in fact, dash says that the result of this is zero, and bash, even in POSIX mode, says it's one. So it's weird again, and maybe this is a good reason why we should not really use this. And in fact, you can, of course, replace it just by the AND and OR operators of the shell, which is a much safer way to do this. Okay. Another interesting thing is, and this is again a design flaw of the shell, is that we found almost 10 errors in the test expressions, in fact, syntactic errors in the test expressions in the maintainer scripts. And now one has to understand why this hasn't been detected before. One would expect that if someone does a syntactic error in a test expression, then the first person who installs the package will find this error and complain and send a bug report. This hasn't happened. Why? In fact, the shell confuses the Boolean conditions, true and false, with presence and absence of errors. Okay, and this is the problem. If you have a syntactic error in a test expression, this will just make the test operator fail, and the shell sees it at false. You might get an error message printed to standard error, but this is easily ignored if you install a lot of stuff. And the result is just that the test does not behave as you would expect it to do. Okay, so I will show you some of these things we have found, stuff like this. This, of course, is false. Pathfind would be a function in this case. And here, of course, you would want to apply the function pathfind to the argument. So this should be something like this. This is something we found several times in scripts. Here, what is missing is just an OR operator between the second and the third sub-expression. Why hasn't this been found before, one might ask? Well, the reason is that, in fact, this test will succeed in case that $1 is removed, and in all other cases, including disappear and purge, it will just fail. So it does something, but it does not what the maintainer intended. This is another one, a classical one. Of course, this is a problem with cutting, with decomposing the input into tokens. What's missing here is a space before the bracket. Everybody has done this mistake. And then again, the test just fails. It always says false. Or this one, so there's a missing continuation line for the same reason. This all also fails just miserably. And we found something like this. The less simple is not even a POSIX test. The backslash is probably not necessary, and anyway, the person probably intended here to do a DPKG compare. Okay. So stuff like this, we found 9 of them, and I think, and of course, we filed bugs against all of them. And then we have redirections.
Yes, that's, and we should maybe hurry because...
Okay.
Okay, this is something we found recently by just saying, are redirection used? Yes, probably, but what's in there? And actually, you can see a lot of these where you, so with these two redirected to one and then one redirected to DevNull, do you know what it does? Are you sure to know what it does? So what it does if, first it takes whatever one was writing to, and say two should write to the same thing, right? So if one was writing to standard output, two is now also writing to standard output. And then it tells you, and now one should write to DevNull. But that means, and this is probably not what is intended when writing something like that, if this foo command here logs something on the standard error, this is now redirected to standard output instead of flushed away. And you probably mean the reverse, that is, first you redirect one to devnull and then two to the same thing as one. All right? And actually, there are like more than 100 occurrences of that possible problem. And so we should discuss probably at some point if we should do a mass bug filing. And also you discover like useless redirections, like one should redirect to the same thing as one, or one should redirect to the, no, yeah, wait. Yes, one should redirect to the same thing as two, and then one should redirect to devnull. So we can detect a few. So these are like non-dangerous bugs, but still bugs nonetheless. Maybe to conclude really fast in order to have a few questions maybe. So we are in the Collie project launched by Ralph here, and we aim at like checking the correctness of Linux scripts in general, and in fact Debian packages in particular. This is a project founded by the Agence Nationale de Recherche, which is just something founding research projects in France. We still have 2 years to have fun with shell scripts. You can check the main page, and in the future we want to go further, and not only on a syntactic level, but look at things with funny names like tree transducers, symbolic execution, to check more interesting properties of scripts. And I think we have like a short time for questions. Thank you for your attention.
Hi there. I haven't done any packaging in a while, but we used to have .config scripts, which were also shell scripts, and they interacted with debconf. Are they still around? And if so, shouldn't you expand the scope of your searching to gather those as well?
Possibly. Well, you have seen that in our project we are already late now, and it's quite complicated. So I think for the moment we prefer to focus on the maintainer scripts. There is just they're all doing similar stuff, and
config scripts are maintainer scripts, or at least they were 10 years ago, 13 years ago. It's 2018 now.
Yeah, they belong to the package.
Yeah, they go into var, lib, dpackage scripts. Oh my gosh, I'm an old timer. I used to maintain x386 back when x386 was a thing.
Are you Brandon?
I'm sorry?
What's your name?
Brandon Robinson.
Brandon Robinson, okay, so I thought I...
Yeah, I've got a lot of painful experience with shell scripts, so that's...
Okay,
what you're doing, by the way. This is excellent work.
Okay.
In fact, these config scripts are just present statically in the archive too, and we can probably just copy their contents into, like, when you do the sources, it's basically just copying the contents and then handling them. That's probably not so much a problem to work on these config scripts.
Yeah, they're just named package name .config, mm-hmm. and mostly they just do reads and writes
I don't understand .config. So.
Yeah, it's a debconf thing.
Okay.
Yes. So. Yeah, that was the last like maintainer script that was added, and it started happening about 2000.
Yeah. Okay. So we still have a lot of doc-based files there, and of course we should include them in the analysis. You're right, because they are setting variables which are used in the script
in the main script after that. Yeah. Don't call it a registry. Yeah.
Okay.
Debconf. I saw your set minus e, etc. Apparently, nobody's ever using the original idea of set the positional parameters. They're just setting the options. Nobody's setting A or 1 and 2 and 3 positional parameters. I do it all the time. But
so we didn't see this in the scripts, and
The results. Like if this is used, this is like in less than 0.4% of the cases of set. So this is really not so much used indeed. All right.
Okay.
I think we are out of time anyway. Yes. he agrees. So thanks again.
Okay.